neighbor. Good morning. Welcome to Sunday morning lecture, Jewish ethics. Before we begin, I'd just like to make let everybody know about this wonderful event next week, next Sunday morning, a day of Torah and unity. It's going to take place in Potomac at Beth Shalom, sponsored by many Kollelim in the community, including Greater Washington Community Kollel. And there'll be classes for men and women, community-wide events. There are flyers there on the table, so please join us for that special event and register. A very special opportunity this morning, very special speaker. We all know that recounting the Omer, today is a very special day in the Omer, Lag BaOmer. We count the days to Kabbalah Satira, Nasa V'Nishma, accept the Torah willingly. The bracha, Brachas HaTorah, we thank Hashem for giving us Torah's Emes, the Torah's Emes, of truth. Very interesting. I mean, what would we think? The Torah is not Emes. It seems to be superfluous to refer to the Torah as a Torah of truth. Darki Musar of Yaakov Naiman says that Torah's Emes, of course the Torah's truth. We wouldn't think otherwise. It's not what we mean when we say Torah's Emes. It's not an adjective about the Torah. But rather, Torah's Emes means that the Torah teaches us the Emes. It's instructive to us about the true way to live our lives. Torah's Emes. We say Shema, brought down in Halacha, Echad, the Aleph, first, the unity of Hashem, the oneness, the Ches and the Dalet. So they represent, the Ches is the earth, and the seven celestial spheres, the Rekiyos, that we're Mamlech HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we make HaKadosh Baruch Hu king. We accept his kingship upon the entire universe. And the Dalet is the four directions, north, east, west, south, all over. We accept God's unity, his mastery of the world, his sovereignty. Bali Musa say, sure, you should have that all in mind, but don't forget to accept HaKadosh Baruch Hu on yourself. The universe, the celestial spheres, but you too. Torah's Emes. From the Kabbalah of the Torah, you know the Torah has wonderful things to say, great thoughts, deep ideas. But we also realize that the Torah, when we accept the Torah's Madrach is there to instruct us in our daily lives, in our daily dealings, in our homes, in how we interact with our neighbors and our friends and our businesses. And that's really what this lecture series is dedicated to, is to teaching and demonstrating and learning how the Torah instructs us in our everyday lives. It's a very special opportunity to have Rabbi Rhein, the Rav of the Southeast Hebrew Congregation, who joins us in August. If some of you didn't get the opportunity to meet Rabbi Rhein, I'm happy that you have the opportunity today to hear him. He's well known for his scholarship and erudition, as well as his great dedication and innovation to reaching Jews of all backgrounds and bringing them the beauty of Torah. And it's a very, very special opportunity for the Kollel, who we partner so closely together. Southeast is very generous in sharing their space with us, and we're very grateful for Rabbi Rhein's partnership and friendship. And it's a great pleasure to call on him to give us his lecture, Jokes and Accidents in Tort Law.
A very good morning. Thank you everyone for joining. like to express specific thanks to the Kolel, to Rabbi Winter, to Rabbi Zakim, to all the Chavri HaKolel, and of course, L'chvod Achsanya, the ongoing host of this program, to Rabbi Rosenbaum, to Yom Gizl Shomrei Amuna. I got a number of comments about the flyer. Some people liked the clown. They thought it was appropriate for Lag BaOmer festivities, the right theme. Some people liked the look of consternation on the clown's face when someone apparently broke his glasses. I also tried to keep ongoing dialogue with the youth of my shul. And so they came over to me and told me that there was a typo in the flyer. They were really not familiar with the word tort. And they were sure that it was supposed to say Torah. Jokes and accidents in Torah law, they felt. One young lady told me that she really hopes it's open to children because she loves tarts like her bubby makes. I told her we're going to have a delicious time together, but I don't think it's geared for the children. So once again, we do thank the shul for hosting these ongoing Torah tort presentations with or without the tarts. Generally speaking, we're aware that we're liable for damages. It's a very general, very forceful awareness in Jewish law. You've done damage, you have to make it right. But sometimes we're tempted to argue, it was only a joke, it was an accident. And here too, there's tremendous case law, guidance, precedence in halacha to guide us as to whether those concepts can somehow make it excusable or not. We start in the handouts with quote number one, a famous Mishnah in Bava Kamma. The Mishnah states, Adam Muad La'olam. A human being is always responsible. Whether he wants to be responsible, whether he's by nature responsible, a human being is supposed to be paying attention, ben shogig, ben mazid, it's an accident, it's on purpose, it makes no difference, you're liable. Ben er, ben yoshein. Whether he's awake or he's sleeping. He's liable. He kicks a pot in the middle of his sleep. He cannot argue. I was sleeping. What do you want from me? You broke it. You have to pay. As forceful as this Mishnah is, it also gives us a glimpse into what we will find are some of the loopholes regarding liability. There's a very big difference regarding a person who does damage in his sleep, whether the item that he damaged, in our case a pot, whether the item that he damaged, in our case a pot, was there before he went to sleep, or was put there after he went to sleep. If it was there before he went to sleep, then he, when he went down to sleep, understanding that when he's asleep, he is not going to be controlling himself, so then he's liable. But if he's lying there, sleeping, and someone else foolishly puts a pot next to him, you know that people who are sleeping don't realize when they stretch. could very well be that the person who put the pot there would be the responsible party. As we will see, there's going to be something termed an ones gomur, a true and absolute accident so extreme that I'm not responsible. Sometimes we think it was only a joke. Well, jokes can get us into trouble. Take a look at quote number two. Osur lignov, afilu kol shehu. You're not allowed to steal, even a little bit. Va'osur lignov, afilu derech chok. And you're not allowed to steal even as a joke. We'll get to that. Afilu amanas lahachzir o kedei l'shalem tashlume kefel. Even if you're stealing for altruistic reasons. I'm not getting into the case of stealing for the sake of saving one's life. Not so extreme. Person who steals for an altruistic reason. He wants to pay double. There's a halacha in the pasuk that if a person steals and we catch him on a gneva, so he's mishalim kefel. He pays back double. So the mefarshim here say, this thief is a tzaddik thief. He wants to give tzedakah to somebody who needs the money and the guy doesn't want to take it. So he steals from him, waits till they catch him, and then says, yippee, you caught me. Can I pay him double? Asur. Not allowed to do it. O mikidei letza'aron. Or to pain somebody. Wanted to tease them. It was just a joke. Hakol asur. It's all forbidden. Because the act of stealing is prohibited. I mentioned the case of life-saving situations of stealing, so I'll just try to package that one little piece before we go on. When a person does have to steal for life-saving reasons, so they have to do so with intent to pay back, and they have to do so. So you may have a patient, and you don't have the equipment, and you jump into someone else's medical bag. You did the right thing. You saved the patient. But you're not just absolved because you stole under duress. You have to pay that doctor back for his equipment or strike a deal. Maybe he'll be happy. But you can't take from somebody without addressing that issue. Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, Rebbe in Torah Vadas, recounts how he once got a shayla in yeshiva that somebody, a roommate, was frustrated with the use of a stereo system that the other roommate was playing too loudly with too much frequency. So one day he decided to play a practical joke. He took the stereo system and moved it from his roommate's cubby to his cubby. And he threw some clothing on top of it. No one should know. So this roommate walks in. He's looking for a stereo, $150 piece. And everybody's, I don't know. No one knows. He went out of the room. He thought. He realized. Comes back in. He checks underneath the clothing and he sees the stereo system. How could you do this to me? It's just a practical joke. He says, just a practical joke. He takes the stereo system and then he reaches between this roommate's third and fourth undershirts and takes $150 and he walked out of the room. Now, the thief, at this point, is who? The thief who took the stereo system in the first place is fuming. It was a practical joke. What did you just do? You took your stereo system back and you took $150? And the owner of the stereo system looks him in the eye and says, "Kefel, you have an obligation to pay double. You stole from me. Afilu derech tzchok, even if you did it as a joke." And that's why I mean, sometimes certain practical jokes can get costly. In quote number 3, we see how far-reaching halacha takes a practical joke. And appreciating this is going to make the exceptions all the more valuable. Because in general, kishem sha'ona b'mekach u'memkar, just like you're not allowed to take advantage of somebody in business, not allowed to sell somebody something over the market value for that item. You're not allowed to buy something from somebody, tricking them. They don't realize the market value, and you undercut them. If it's more than a certain percentage, you could actually undo the transaction. The same way, you're not allowed to take advantage like that. Kacho na'a b'dvarim. Same thing, you're not allowed to take advantage of somebody unawares by saying certain things. Gedola anas devarim anas mamon. It's actually in certain ways considered more severe. Shezanitin lehishavon v'zela nitin lehishavon. Because money advantage, you can pay up. You can reimburse the person for what you've done wrong and call it a day. I had a friend in yeshiva who used to say, the easiest debts to pay are financial debts. You pay it, it's money. But when you insult somebody, when you take advantage of them intellectually, emotionally, how are you going to pay it back? Hatsoek alonuas devarim ne'enemiyad. A person who calls out from that moment of affliction is answered. And if he doesn't have kind words to say about us, it doesn't do well in heaven. A friend of mine attended Camp Dora Golding. So she told me that there was a little practical joke that the girls liked to play on the office girl. They would call the office from a payphone when payphones were in, and they would ask, "Is Dora in?" And this was the youthful joke in Camp Dora Golding. "Is Dora in?" It's cute. It's funny. But it's at someone's expense. Unless you have, a certain degree of accommodation, are you allowed to do that or not? Take a look at quote number 4. Kate said, "Hu alnoas devorim." Give me an example of alnoas devorim, the Mechaber says in Shulchan Aruch. "Lo yoma," you're not allowed to say, "bekama tarot segliten chefetz zeh." How much are you willing to sell this item to me? V'hu eino rotza liknoso, and you have no intent on buying. It's a tease. Proprietor of a store is waiting for a customer. If you're window shopping, if you're just curious, tell him that. But if you take advantage of him and he starts, "I'll tell you, I would go down $10 if you're willing to buy two of them." What are you taking advantage of him for? The Mechaber wonders. If workers are looking to buy grain, lo yomalem, you're not allowed to tell them, go to so-and-so who yodeya she'en lo limkar, and you know that this person he's not in the grain business. What would some people say? Shrug, practical joke. Oh no, you're taking advantage of somebody. Not allowed to do it. And then a famous one, Imhaya Chaveru Bal Tshuva, person used to be doing the wrong thing. Lo yoma lo, you're not allowed to say to them, Zechor ma'asecha harishon, remember. Chavetz Chaim says, even if you include yourself, remember when we used to eat in the non-kosher restaurant. I included myself. Oh, maybe it doesn't bother you, but it bothers him. And he doesn't want that mentioned in public. Not allowed to do it. 5. Va'af lignov da'as habriyos b'dvarim. Even to steal a person's intent. Shemara she'osa b'shvilov ve'ena osa. You make it look like you're doing the person a favor, like you're a really good friend of theirs, and you're really not doing that favor at all. One of the cases that's given is a person has a big barrel, and you ask for 1 ounce of product, oil, wine, and the guy says, oh, I'm going to open a barrel for you. And the only reason he's opening the barrel is because he has a catering event that afternoon. But he makes it look like he's doing you a favor. For 1 ounce, for you. What's the problem? The problem is that you're heightening his expectations of his relationship with you. And if you ask him for a favor, he's going to think I have to reciprocate. You could say I was just being funny. It's Geneva. Lo yisari. Not allowed to pressure somebody to eat by you, knowing that they won't accept the invitation. This is very delicate. Someone just told me they had a very, very close friend in Florida. She was getting married, a second marriage. She didn't bother sending an invitation to Florida, to this friend. Because she figures she can't come anyway. What am I sending her an invitation for? And there was a terrible fallout in the relationship. You got married and you didn't send me an invitation? So on the one hand, yes, you got to send an invitation, even if they're not going to come. On the other hand, lo yisarhei, you can't pressure them, knowing that they won't come, just to make it sound like, we're going to miss you so much, please come, we're best friends, aren't we? How can you not come? To the point that the person starts feeling like you're really best friends. You've heightened their expectations falsely. Genevastar. I'd like now to start going into a corridor of loopholes. And as you travel down this hallway, so to speak, you can't quite see exactly the garden, when we're going to be able to apply it, when not, but we're going to be able to start getting glimpses as to very, very far-reaching leniencies, if you will, on this topic of jokes and accidents. And what really heightens the appreciation for this is the entire preamble, if you will, that we just did, recognizing under normal conditions how sensitive we are to forbid jokes and accidents. Number one, the last quote on page one. Yesh Omrim. There's an opinion brought by the Ramah. De'ei mitzuvim alonoas devorim elo yirei Hashem. You're only forbidden on onoas devorim of certain types if it's a person who's an upright individual. Umishema ana atzma mutar lahoneyu. But a person who does this type of offensive behavior, you're allowed to reciprocate. Now, there are two interpretations in the Sma, which are worthy of appreciating. One approach is the person speaks of themselves in this negative way. So you get the impression that they don't mind. And the other approach is they dish it out. And the expression is, if you dish it out, you have to be willing to take it. So there's a certain level that's not quite an insult. We've heard it at the Shabbos table sometimes, where it's not polite, it's underhanded, but in certain families, like, that level of bickering is considered normal. If it's normal, though it could be within reason, it might actually be normal. You got to be very careful, though. Because just because a person says about themselves, I am so stupid, doesn't mean they will appreciate or forgive you if you say to them, yes, you are so stupid. It doesn't go over the same way. So that's a very delicate heter, but we need to know it. Because yes, in some settings, voices get raised, and people who are in those settings understand. We're still best of friends. Sometimes I've noticed it in Hashkacha, when you're in food service kitchen, an hour before an event, tensions start rising. And you watch workers, co-workers, bosses, in the stress of the moment, they say things. And you come back later when things calm down and you recognize that they understand that that's the language of the industry, so to speak. I'm not saying it's okay. The Chafetz Chaim in food industry presumably would not engage in such. But there are changes of standard based on different situations, which is a phenomenal gateway to the three tshuvas which I'd like to share with you this morning. On page number two, the Shulchan Aruch writes, basic normative Jewish law. Bachurim harochvim lekras chasam v'kalo. You have young men on horses galloping towards the chasam and kalo. Obviously a very socially appropriate activity in their time. The ziku zezeh derech simcha uschok. And they damaged each other in the midst of this joyous experience. Nowadays, I haven't seen anyone bring in a horse to the Chasna Hall, certainly not two. But sometimes in the midst of dancing, someone steps on your new shoes, makes a dent, scuffs them. What's his liability? Hoil v'noagu kein, since this is the custom of the activity, peturim. They're not liable. Mikol makom, nevertheless, im nira lebezdin lasos siyag v'geder, if it seems appropriate to Bezdin to step in and say, whoa, you went too far, harishus biyadam, they're allowed to do so. But the normative psak is, that's all part of the fun. And somehow it's okay. We need to see why and what the parameters would be. Quote number 8, V'yesh Amrim, there's another great leniency that can be found in the laws of Purim. Im hizik echad es chaveiro mikolach simchas Purim. If one person damaged his fellow in the midst of Purim joy, potom in l'shalem, you're absolved. Person is a little tipsy. They hug somebody in a loving way. They end up knocking off their glasses. What's the liability? I remember in yeshiva, it was classic. Young man would come over to his Rebbe, give him a big hug, and call out, Rebbe, show me the Derech HaTorah! It depends how much the guy squeezes the Rebbe's neck, whether, it gets tolerated or not. We have sirens. I didn't plan that. How far do you go with that heter? Let's see the case material that's the basis for this ruling in Shulchan Aruch and see how far we could possibly take this. Quote number 9, the Rosh. Shenayim shenis afku yachad. We had a case where two people were wrestling. Legalized wrestling, consensual wrestling. V'hipil ha'echad es chaveiro la'oret. One of them pushed his friend to the ground. V'nafal alav, and he fell on him. U'v'naflu alav sima eino shel ha'tachton. And as he fell on him, an accident happened, and he blinded the person who was on the ground. His hand landed in the wrong spot. God protect us. Mirali de Potter. He's absolved. He doesn't have to pay for the damage that he did, as enormous as the damage is. And even though we know there's a rule, a person is always liable. So don't give me none of this accident stuff, the Rosh says. Heichadu ones gamur potter. If it is a total accident, beyond our control, so to speak, a real mistake, then you're potter. Says the Rosh, I want you to understand where I'm coming from. What's the basis for my ruling? We learned in Perek HaMeiniach in Baba Kama, laws of damages, Isi ben Yehuda Omer, Rots Chayim. If a person runs in the public area, he's liable for the damage that he does. Because he's doing differently than everybody else. Everybody else is walking normally. He decides to run. So yes, it was an accident. He turned the corner and bumped into somebody. But he was running. And he had no business running. Moda Isi ben Yehuda. But Isi ben Yehuda, as strongly as he holds, you're not allowed to run and you're liable for the damage that you do. Berat be'erev Shabbos ben Hashmoshos. If you're running minutes before Shabbos, you could just see the person running from Shalom's with his last minute purchase. Running on the sidewalk. Shu potter. Then he's potter. Why? Mishum sharat spirishut. Because in a Jewish society, in a Jewish neighborhood, there's a heightened awareness moments before Shabbos that people are rushing. And therefore, he's rushing, other people are rushing, and suddenly rushing becomes the norm. V'mhayu shneihem rotzim v'iziku zeh zeh shelo b'kavona pturim. If both people were rushing, we don't figure out, okay, who damaged who more. They both damaged each other. We call it a wash because they were both behaving within the norm, and therefore it's considered an ones gamur. The chaybenidon zeh, the Rosh says, and I'd like to compare that case to the case of wrestling. Because nisafku zeh im zeh midah shneim, because they're wrestling consensually. They agreed to wrestle. This is not one bully comes over to someone else. They agreed. This is fun. Shelo b'kavona, they had no intent to do damage. Because everybody knows that ikar kavanosam shayatel ho echad es chaveiro. Everybody knows that the goal in wrestling is to push your friend to the ground. And when you succeed, listen, I can't make sure to flip him to the ground gently. I can't do that. He shouldn't get hurt. They wrestle with all of their strength. They're each trying to flip their fellow. And with that intent, they agreed to wrestle. What the Rosh is describing is a different environment. We're walking down in a social hall normally. No one's running. There's normal behavior. You're walking. But if it's a running environment, the Rosh says, I have precedent to tell you that it's normal to run. And if you're on the street during a running environment, a whole different set of rules. So if you both have agreed to some recreational activity, whether it's bungee jumping or paintball or whatever activity you choose, for example, wrestling, then it comes with its operational hazards. And in that setting, the Rosh says, you're potter. The Sma, when this is brought in Shulchan Aruch, gives an explanation, which we still need to work further, but his explanation is, quote number 10, Ki'ilu nisya'ashu umachlu ahadadi. It's as if they gave up already as they're going into the wrestling match. And they were mochel, they forgave it. Which begs the question, isn't that a case of asmachta? We know that there are times, for example, in betting, that Chazal referred to the behavior as gezel, theft. Because when the person made the bet and made the commitment, he had no expectation at all that he would have to pay. He was so sure that he's going to win. For example, if a person relinquishes money for a lottery ticket, he can argue as much as he wants that he played his lucky numbers. But he relinquished the money. It was clear to him, based on odds, that money is out of his hands and it's not coming back according to any normal expectation. But when a person does betting and keeps the money in his wallet, so Chazal questions, when he loses, if he loses, he's going to have to pull money out of his pocket and start paying up in a transaction that he never really focused expectation to have to pay up. Asmachta lo kanya. It's a question that you're actually stealing from him now. As you take that money, he'll pay it up because, gentleman's honor, but he doesn't really want to pay up, and he had no expectation to pay up. somehow, and this needs to be defined further, the wrestling mechila is better than that. As the person walks into the wrestling match, undoubtedly he expects to win. He expects that I'm stronger, and no one's going to be able to hurt me. I know exactly how to block his punches. I know exactly how to get him to the ground before he gets me. Nevertheless, somehow, there's a mechila, a forgiveness, that is going to absolve the wrestlers according to the Rush. Let's take a look at page 3 and see another example of how this principle can or cannot be applied. The Truma Tadeshan, who was one of the heavyweights in early Psak Halacha, Tshuvas upon whom the Ramah relies heavily, discusses in quote 11 a very heavy shaila. He describes, Ba'u lefanai ladin, two people came in judgment before me, Rabbi Eliezer bar Shalom and Rabbi Gershom bar Shalom. A certain Rabbi Eliezer and a certain Rabbi Gershom, both of whom's father's names were Shalom. One has the right to conjecture here, inquisitively, were they brothers? You know, the Kamsa and Bar Kamsa story, according to many Mefarshim, wasn't just two ordinary people, one whose name was Kamsa and one whose name was Bar Kamsa. One was invited to the meal, one was not. The one who was not was thrown out, causing the churban of the second Beit HaMikdash. Many Mefarshim learn it was father and son. Bar Kamsa, the son of Kamsa, was accidentally invited to that meal. Bar Shalom, both of their father's names was Shalom. Conjectures aside, the question is as follows. Sok Rabbi Eliezer or Rabbi Gershon, Rabbi Eliezer has a problem. His complaint against Reb Gershom is that during Hoshinus on Sukkot, this Reb Gershom took them and pushed them down. Kasher hayasone lo kvar zayomim v'shanim, because there was already a hatred from before. He broke his shoulder, v'niskak l'rofe, he needs medical attention, and this Reb Gershom hides behind a very simple excuse. Help me here. It was an accident. It was an accident. What do you want from me? If it's true that I pushed him, it was not with any intent to hurt him. Truma Tadeshin says he spent a lot of time with them and trying to figure out what really happened. There were many umdenos v'halchachos. There were many indications that it was done purposely. Because this Reb Gershon had threatened the night before to push Reb Eliezer during Hakafos the next day. And afterwards, on his way out, you could just picture the scene with the EMTs, with the lights flashing, he walks out to a group of people that have congregated, and he says, why didn't you help your friend when he was on the floor? Indicating to anybody who was paying attention that this was indeed malicious, even though he never said the words and never, it's not provable. Says the Truma Tadeshan, circumstantial evidence is not enough to obligate somebody. we need to know that he did it purposely and not by mistake. But because of the umdenos v'halchachos, because of all the indicators that are here, it is necessary to come down strong in some method of knas, of levying a fine against this Reb Gershom. What's interesting, if you'll notice the underline in the middle of the page, is that the Trumas HaDeshen is both giving us how strong the Heter is, how lenient we might be, and also telling us how you must come down strong nevertheless in certain cases. He writes, the imlokive laziko, if he didn't intend to hurt him, afagav devadai nitzak mikocho, even though it's traceable, and we know for sure that he was damaged because of him, poto miklum, he would not be obligated, even though he's lying on the floor with a broken arm. That's pretty far-reaching. That's significant damage, but because it was in the midst of normal behavior for a mitzvah in a setting that's a little rough, bumping into each other, I don't know if we can tune into this, every society is different, but he describes that that was still within the norm, if not for the fact that we have some questions about this Reb Gershon's motives. Just for curiosity, I'd like to share with you the level of tshuva that the Trumas HaDeshen obligates, even though he's not comfortable in making him pay straight out for the damages. He says, Hineni matel al Reb Gershon, sheyasa charata u'mechila, that he's going to have to go publicly and announce in shul that he did wrong. While the Sefer Torah is on the bima, you know, the time when the rabbi says you're not allowed to talk, he's going to have to go up in front of everyone, in front of the Aron, and he's going to have to call out, Chatasi l'Elokei Yisrael, I sinned to Hashem and to you, Rabbi Eliezer, because I was disgraceful in my behavior in shul, and I transgressed on the words of the Torah that say, you're not allowed to hurt another person. Now, try giving that script to somebody nowadays and seeing how it'll go over. Trumas HaDeshen says, as a bare minimum, that's what's required. But he still says, it's hard to extract money from somebody if it's not provable at the time that he did it with intent beyond what the normal accidental nature of going hakafas is. He specifies at the bottom, last paragraph, Beis Zehuvim, two gold coins, and this Reb Eliezer, who got damaged, is not allowed to pocket them. He's not allowed to pocket it. He gives it le'eza mitzvah she'yirsa, to whatever money, to whatever tzedakah cause he wants, because it's a knas, it's a fine. It's not true damages, because the Trumas HaDeshen was so uncomfortable with the case as not being truly provable. Yes. Beautiful. Beautiful. We get into this question that the words that he used the night before, that I'm going to do this to you, definitely indicates premeditation. The question that we get into here is classic both in financial law and in general halacha. Whenever you have a logic, you have to test it in both directions if you want to consider it provable. What we would have to do over here, for example, is we would have to know how many people say the night before, I'm gonna kill you, and nothing ends up happening the next morning. In order to know if this language is in fact so traceable that we could hold him liable, we would have to know that it really is sequential. And it seems from the Truma Tadeshen that even the person's statement of premeditation, if you can't prove at the time that he did it with intent, right? If you could prove at the time that he did it, that he did it with intent, then he would not be able to argue, well, it was just in a moment of anger. You've been talking about doing this for weeks. So maybe that would help. But if it just happened in the setting where this Reb Gershon successfully orchestrated it in a way where it looked like an accident, the Truma Tadeshen says it puts us in a precarious position how to enforce it, how to put an end to such behavior, even though there's a leniency here. It's hard to extract money if it might legitimately have been done as an accident. What's fascinating, just one more observation here, is that the Truma Tadeshen's compelling reasons for issuing a fine are twofold. One reason he gives is because if this continues, people are going to stop attending the Hakafas on Sukkot, because this could become a forum for misbehavior. It's a loophole. We can't allow this to continue, so he levies a fine. He also says that you need to contemplate how horrendous this is, that a person is using the shul as a forum for his personal vendetta in front of the Aron, in front of the Sefer Torah. The expression is from the Megillas Esther, Hagam Lichtosh es Hamalka imi Babayis. You're trying to do it right in front of me, Hashem says. It's the worst of the worst. So as a fine, Beis Din can come down strong. I don't know the value of 2 gold coins. But standing up in front of shul is presumably embarrassing enough to assure us that this is not going to happen again. But to extract money as a damage was very challenging to the Truma Tadeshen. Let's turn to page 4. We have a case here. You could decide if this is more or less provocative than the previous one. But the Bach, quote number 12, gives us a case that there was a person in the midst of a chasna, chasen kala, festivities, v'zorak zuchuchis el hakotel. He threw a glass against the wall, a vase, a glass, something. And it broke, shattered, and it blinded the eye of a person who was present in the room. The glass went everywhere and shattered someone's eye. What's the liability of this foolish man who threw the glass? So the Bach writes, Shita, it's obvious that we saw it, we know it happened. Havaleli hizoyer mitchilosh lo yishtaker. This person should have been careful not to get drunk in the first place. So even if he's arguing, listen, in my drunken state, this was normal behavior, maybe, maybe not. But who asked you to get into that drunken state that you're losing control of normal, sensible behavior? Umashakosav, in the second paragraph, Lepotro, you want to absolve him because he did it. Mitoch simcha shel mitzvah below miskaven lahazik. And I know you're going to want to invoke this leniency that we have, that if it was normative behavior in that situation, without intent, he should be absolved. Says the Bach, which the Mishneh Berurah follows this ruling, he says, if it's a hezek gadol, if it's a great damage, which blinding someone's eye certainly is, ein bozeh din minhag klal. That there's no such custom to absolve him. The Bach differentiates between a hezek gadol and a hezek katan. If it's a small damage, then the festivity environment can create an allowance, a tolerance. But if it's a great damage, there's no such leniency. You'll see that in the Mishneh Berurah, quote 13. Bebach mechalek ben hezek gadol lekatan, ben beguf ben bemamon, behezek gadol makpidin. On a great damage, we're makpid, we don't forgive, and he would have to pay. Vein minig lifter behezek gadol, there is no such leniency on a great damage. Let's think back for a moment, though. We had cases where a guy was on the floor, broken arm. One could assume as well that that's a hezek gadol, that's a great damage. We had a case where a person was blinded in the midst of wrestling. That's a hezek gadol, that's a great damage. Why was the Rosh and the Trumas Hadeshin so hesitant to obligate the person? It's a hezek gadol, obligate them. And the answer, I believe, is that there are two ways that the word minig is being used in this sugya. One way is that initially they walk into the situation according to a minig or custom or in a certain allowance. This is the normal behavior. That was the description of a person who's running on Erev Shabbos, Birushus. It's normal to be running. It's normal to be wrestling in this situation. It's normal to be jostling somebody when you're in the midst of certain types of dancing, certain types of festivity. That's one type of allowance. That allowance is very far-reaching. As the Erech Shai, quote number 14, explains, because when you went in initially, there was a tolerance to consider this behavior normal. Once this behavior is normal, so then the accident that occurred from that now normal behavior is considered an ones gamur. A total accident. That's the case of wrestling. You bump into each other. You knock someone to the ground. We've agreed that you can knock me to the ground and I can knock you to the ground. We have a different level of tolerance. We're playing paintball. That's what we're playing. I am shooting you. You are shooting me. Okay? Now, an unanticipated, wild accident that doesn't usually happen in such activity happens as an accident, so then it's an accident. That's the legitimate case where we say, how unfortunate, but it's an ones gamur, he's not liable. Because within the framework of the activity they agreed upon to do, this accident emanated, and that's what happened. There's a different type of way that the word minig is being used here as well. People are sitting by a chasna. Does anybody expect somebody to go and throw a glass against the wall to shatter? What? What are you doing? He says, listen, my threshold was altered because I drank too much and it was festive and I wasn't thinking. So on something like that, because of the environment, there may be a minig on a hezek katan, on a small damage, that, okay, it's all part of the game. Person on Purim kicks you on the shoe and he scuffs your shoe. It could be there's mechila on that. What's he doing? Okay, I don't know what he's doing, but it's Purim, and you know, on a hezek katan, on a small damage, there's a degree of tolerance. But the Bach says, and the Mishneh Berurah says, as far as ruling goes, that on such behavior, it's only on a hezek katan, on a small damage, certainly not on a big damage. I'd like to conclude with a thoughtful application. Rabbi Avigdor Miller has on one of his recordings that he was at a kiddush, and a wealthy man known in the community was sitting next to him. And as Rabbi Miller reached for the cholent and took, and however, somehow, he managed accidentally to drop some cholent on this man's pants. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." After Shabbos, Rabbi Miller wrote a check. In those days, I think it was $7.50 to clean a suit. So, he mailed the check to the man, and in Rabbi Miller's words, he cashed the check! This wealthy man, he cashed the check! And he's right, Rabbi Miller concludes, because I damaged him. I don't care how much money he has. I damaged him. My question, thought-provoking. Rabbi Miller held he was chayiv. He sent the check. The wealthy man held he was chayiv. He cashed the check. Thought-provoking question. It's a kiddush. Things happen. Is that in any way related to the types of accidents that we're talking about or not? I thank you for joining. I thank you for listening. Have a wonderful Lag BaOmer.
Thank you, Rabbi Rein, so much for your very scholarly lecture, insightful lecture. I just want to thank Rabbi Rosenbaum, Shomri Amuna for hosting us, this wonderful event, and many of the programs that we do together for their partnership. I want to thank Mr. Rosenberg, the office, for all the nuts and bolts putting it together. I want to thank Rabbi Zakum for all the behind-the-scenes work, for bringing this all together, and of course all of you for coming and for joining us today, this morning, on Lag BaOmer. And Rabbi Rein will be happy to answer questions, whoever may have. Thank you very much, and happy Lag BaOmer. What?